But he's maybe not best known, but on your bio it says you're best known as the founder and columnist for Leo. But that's how I knew John Yarwath before he went to Congress, and many of you did too. His diverse career has included work in public policy, business, higher education, and healthcare. He was born and raised in Louisville. He's a graduate of Atherton High School and Yale University. He and his wife, Kathy, have a son, Aaron, who is here today and who graduated from Indiana University in 2006. So let's welcome John Yarwath. He'll give an opening statement, then I'll introduce the other two.
Well, thank you very much, Mark, and it's great to be here. Jasmine, Trey, great to be here with you to talk about something that I've actually been talking about in one form or another for a couple of years, if not longer. We have a real problem in this country in terms of our public dialogue, and there are many, many facets of the problem. The one thing that is ironic about what's happened over the last few weeks is there's really no evidence that political rhetoric directly led to Jared Loughner's attack on Gabby Giffords and those who were there to talk with her. But one of the silver linings could be that we actually do make a change in our public discourse, and that we learn to actually talk about things that matter instead of things that don't. One of the things that, having tried to deal with public policy over the last 4+ years, is that everything we deal with, or virtually everything we deal with now in public policy, is really complicated stuff. Really complicated stuff. And we don't know how to have the kind of discussions about complicated topics. We want to put everything in convenient silos. We want to make things black and white, right or wrong, and virtually nothing that we have to deal with falls easily into those categories. There are things that are contributing to this that we will get into as the discussion goes on, including the way we elect people, the primary systems we have, not just the polarization of the two parties, but the dominance of extreme elements in both parties. And of course, the media play an enormous role in what has happened to our discourse. And I will just mention this one little anecdote. A few weeks ago, I was in a kind of a sample boot camp of media training. There were six of us House Democrats who have done a lot of media, talking to a couple people who were saying, we want to do this for everybody in the Democratic caucus, this training, and so they wanted to try it out on us. And one of the people there was actually a Broadway actor who has spent over the last few years a lot of time actually dealing with public officials trying to train them to do media appearances. And one of the things that he said, and I did over 100 national media appearances during the healthcare debate, and I never ever heard this, but I kind of thought something was strange. So whenever you're on cable news shows and you're part of a panel where you have a split screen, the first thing you want to do when you sit down and you put your IFB in, your earpiece, is turn the volume down, because they deliberately turn it up so that you will be encouraged, or you will be psychologically tempted to speak louder, to yell. And that's what they want. They want you, they want the conflict, they want the noise, they want the volume. And they've succeeded in getting it. But anyway, one of the things that I think, again, is most important about this, clearly there is the potential danger of very outrageous dialogue, because you never know who you're reaching, as in the case possibly of Jared Loughner. But the thing that concerns me more than the actual physical threat is the threat to democracy. Because, again, right now the average soundbite on television news in the country is 9.8 seconds. And you can't really talk much about healthcare or financial reform, energy legislation, whatever it is, in 9.8 seconds. You can demonize somebody, you can throw out catchphrases that tend to inflame people, and it's not very healthy for coming to grips with the serious problems we have when you can't discuss them. So anyway, I'm going to close here. Thank you all for being here. I'm looking forward to the discussion because, again, this will be much more than 10 seconds, and we'll be actually having an opportunity to have a very civil and thoughtful discussion. And before I turn it back to Mark, I want to congratulate Trey on his new position. It's a very, very important role. He was chosen from an incredibly competitive national field, and I think he'll do great things at Harvard, and I'm also glad he's leaving the competitive partisan arena in Kentucky.
Yeah. Yeah, for those of you who don't know, John Yarmuth is a Democrat, Trey is a Republican, so. And here at the University of Louisville, we appreciate the idea that we can have public discourse here and share ideas and get on each other a little bit without being disagreeable. Trey Grayson was elected to office as Secretary of State in November of 2000. It was his first run for public office. At the time of his election, he was the youngest Secretary of State in the country. And in 2007, he became one of only two Republican statewide elected constitutional officers to win a second consecutive term in modern Kentucky history. Since taking office, Grayson has quickly become a national leader in elections, civics, business services, and government innovation. And as you just heard, Trey will be taking a new job here in, what, 7 days, I think, something like that?
Yeah, a week from today is my first day.
A week from today, he is just taking the job as the director of the Harvard School of Politics, which is a big-time job. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Glad you're here.
Thanks, Mark. And after this discussion, if you all want to continue to have civil discourse with me, you can help me pack. You know, load up the car on Saturday to drive up to Havid. I'm going to keep my R's in the middle of the words and not at the end of the words up there. And I'm going to do my best to make sure my two daughters still sound like they're from Kentucky. No offense to anybody here who's from up east. Yeah. Like I said, no offense. See, civil discourse. I want to, since John concluded by saying something nice about me, I want to begin by saying something nice about John. When he first got elected, I'd watched him on Comment on Kentucky. I'd seen him a lot on Comment on Kentucky, but we didn't meet until he first filed for office when he ran for Congress in 06 year, the year? Yeah, 2006. So when he got elected, one time I was in Washington shortly after his victory, and yeah, I'm a Republican, he's a Democrat, but I wanted to get to know him better. So my staff reached out to his office during one of my trips to D.C. around our Secretary of State's conference. And so he agreed to meet with me, and at the last minute I remember they said, well, wait a minute, let's just do lunch. And so John took me to lunch in the Congressional Dining Room. So here are a conservative Republican and a liberal, I think that's, you like that word, right? Progressive, which word do you want me to use?
Okay. Liberal's fine.
Progressive, liberal, Democrat. We're having lunch, and actually I remember he
as
had to go.
As long as it's not communist.
Yeah,
okay.
He had to go vote a couple times at lunch, and what was interesting is I would have voted opposite of the way he voted on every single vote where he left. But we had a great conversation, and we've been able to maintain that relationship ever since. And I know my congressman, Congressman Davis, has a very, again, would vote differently than you on a lot of issues, but has a very good personal relationship. And I know you and he used to do a lot before Francine passed away, did a lot of, maybe the only two members of Congress doing that on the radio show, where the two of them would get on and talk about what's going on in Washington, and Francine would moderate. And it was the epitome of civil discussion. And that's something that I've really tried as your Secretary of State to really focus on. And it's something that, we as elected officials, we can all do better. I mean, this is one of the things where we all are guilty at times of using inflammatory language, vilifying our opponents, whether they're in your own party, if it's in a primary, or whether it's in the fall. We're all guilty. Some are more guilty than others. I'd like to think I've been less guilty. But I know that I've said things that I wish I hadn't said, and at times I shouldn't have said it. It's one thing when you're a fancy farm in Kentucky. That's a different set of rules than I think we need to have in other settings. Gabby Giffords is a friend of mine. When I was named to be the director at the Institute of Politics, I sent an email out to a bunch of friends around the country saying, hey, I'm real excited about this position, put the press release on the bottom. And that night, I'm a UK guy, sorry. I like U of L, though, but I'm a UK grad. So my wife and I were going down to watch the minor league bowl game that UK was playing in down in Birmingham. And as we were driving down, she was driving, and emails kept coming back, text messages, phone messages from people congratulating me, and I got one back from Gabby. And she and her husband Mark had become friends with Nancy and me at a fellowship where it was a young elected officials fellowship where folks from both parties, Republicans and Democrats, came together. We talked about democracy, we talked about civility, we talked about leadership, and became friends. And Gabby and I had kept up over the years, and actually on election night this past year, election eve this past year, we texted each other beforehand. I wished her luck in her race, and I was glad that she won. So I got this great email back from her that she and Mark wanted to come up to Boston and work with me in my new job, and she mentioned wanting to pursue this conversation we're going to have today about civility and political discourse. It's something we talked about in the past. And so after the tragedy happened in Tucson, Ryan Alessi, I don't know if Ryan's here or not, but Ryan had gotten a copy of the email and so wrote a story, and then I ended up being on TV all around the country, and it's a little bit odd and awkward talking about it, I got to confess. But it was an important topic. It is an important topic. It's an important topic to Gabby, and I'm glad we're having these kinds of conversations. I don't have a lot of great solutions other than, we've got a few we'll talk about later, but I think all of us have it in themselves to dial down the earpiece, to dial down that dialogue. But one thing I think we have to be careful to not do is use this as an excuse to not defend forcefully our positions. And not to, it's okay, legislation you have to compromise sometimes, but not unnecessarily compromise your principles. That's not what we're talking about here. Let's be clear about that. What we're talking about is people who maybe disagree on an issue, finding common ground, or if there's an area where you probably would have that common ground, don't automatically assume that just because one's a Republican or Democrat or a liberal conservative that there isn't something where you can work together. And I think that's one of the things that we see too often in Frankfurt and we see too often in Washington is just this reflexive, oh, I can't work with him or her because he or she's on the other side. And you just ignore where you can work together. So I'm looking forward to talking to more about this in detail, but it's I'm glad we're having this, and thanks to Mark and to U of L for organizing it.
Okay, very good. Thank you. You know what you were talking about, keeping your R's in the middle of sentences and stuff? Well, Jasmine grew up in Brooklyn, New York. Jasmine Ferrier is from Brooklyn, New York. She developed her interest in political science as an undergrad at the University of Wisconsin. In graduate school, she studied American political development at the University of Texas and received her PhD in government in 2000. She was a postdoctorate fellow at the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia from 2000 to 2001. And in 2002, Ferrier, lucky for us, joined the Department of Political Science at the University of Louisville. Her current research includes a new book project on Supreme Court cases. I don't know if this is an old bio. Didn't you already finish that? Anyways, concerning the legislative process and the separation of powers. Or either that or you've forgotten all about that project you were working on when this bio was written.
Well, I say yes to a lot of university invitations.
But Jasmine Ferrier is a political science professor here at the University of Louisville, and the students love her and think she has great classes. And she was all over the media during the last election cycle talking and providing commentary on the elections as they were going along. So, Jasmine, welcome.
Thank you. I hope you're nicer to me than Chris Matthews was.
Yeah, she was on MSNBC with Chris Matthews. He was pretty tough.
Well, I was told today not to be professorial, but I'm going to exercise my prerogative and say that this is about three things. Okay. The first thing is that this is not new. I want to read a very brief quotation that may give Trey Grayson a little comfort. This is by the president of Yale University. If Jefferson is elected, the Bible will be burned. The French Marseillaise will be sung in Christian churches, and we may see our wives and daughters, the victims of legal prostitution, soberly dishonored and speciously polluted. So my first point is that this is not new, and although we have every right to feel sorry for ourselves, to live in a time of very coarse discourse, we have to remember that in a free society, we have seen this type of behavior before. It's not only about elections, it's also about policy and the people who advocate for policy. This has gone on for a long time. That's point number one. Point number two is that, to your comfort, political science is on this. And these are the ways that political science tries to figure out causality. As you see in the news, sometimes causality is certainly inappropriate. We don't know when one thing causes another. But the types of things that political scientists look into are the following. How is discourse used in elections? How do elite discourses, meaning the people who we elect, affect regular people? In other words, how do members of Congress speak on the floor? How do they vote on the floor? Is it more polarized than it used to be? Are the average Americans more polarized than we used to be? These are the types of questions that are complicated, and I think I echo the congressman's remark. It's not just hard to talk about politics and policy, it's also hard to figure out how things affect each other. The third point I'd like to make in an opening, which I'm sure we'll cover quite a bit, is about polarization. It's hard to imagine, but there was a time only a few decades ago when the two parties were considered too similar, and there wasn't a dime's worth of difference between the parties. An awkward part about American political life is that we have two parties. What this means is that within the two parties, there is a lot of conflict about which ideas and which agendas, which regions, which ideologies will be most important to that party. But of course, sometimes the parties separate and they become very distinct. As the congressman implied, it papers over a lot of complicated questions that we should be dealing with perhaps a little bit more openly. But at the end of the day, we only have the two parties, and that does complicate how we align ourselves in the political universe, and also it makes it very hard for them to figure out how to make their differences clear while also learning how to govern. And those two pieces of political life are always in tension with each other.
So let me ask you, do you think the public, oh, go ahead, Jed, were you going to say
do you think
the public understands the difference between discourse on policy and discourse that is personal and that is attacking and that is intended to jibe up the whole the political arena and get folks to take one side or the other? Do you think the average person understands the difference? And do politicians understand the difference? Jasmine, you go
okay.
If you want to.
Well, ideology is a tricky question. Ideology is very different from policy. If we take a big ideological question like, do we want the government more involved in our lives? That seems like a simple question, but it has two very different strains. Do we want the government more involved in our pocketbooks, or do we want the government more involved in our bedrooms? Both parties have flipped responses to those questions. So the stereotypical Democrat wants politicians in the pocketbook, but out of the bedroom. And the stereotypical Republican wants the opposite, get in the bedroom, out of the pocketbook. I think it is hard for the average person to consume political information when the parties are ideologically separate but internally inconsistent. If we throw the mix of where we should be in the world, then we'll know that Republicans and Democrats also have changed over time about whether or not to engage other countries and how. So in short, yes, it is confusing for the average person to see two parties that are so mixed up sometimes internally. There are other countries around the world where interest groups are parties, like Israel or Italy. And you can have an AARP party. You can have an NRA party. That might make things a little clearer, but then it's hard to govern because there's no clear majority sometimes.
Okay.
I will say one thing about the politicians. I think there are many, and I'm going to speak now, unless I say differently, I'm speaking now about congressional politics and congressmen and women. Not city council people, not state legislators and so forth. In Congress, I would say that there are probably a majority of the members in Congress don't know the difference. And not just that they don't know the difference between politics and policy, they don't try to analyze whether there's a difference. Policy and politics become one, and that because there are an awful lot of people in Congress who are there as a job that they desperately want to keep. They really don't have a sense of purpose there except to stay there. And then there are those in Congress, and we now have probably 50 or 60 new members who fall into this category, who are ideological, who are there because of ideology. They're purely because ideology and partisan politics have merged for them. And so I don't think they know the difference. Probably, again, less than half actually do understand the difference. And as far as the American people are concerned, I have no clue. I'm still trying to figure that out.
Do you want to weigh in, Trey?
Sure. I'm a glasses. This water bottle is half full. That's the kind of person I am, and I'd like to think, and I usually believe that the public does, get it. And it's sometimes the representatives that don't get it. But I think one of the things that makes it tough right now, we live in an interesting time right now. The public can gain can learn so much more about the individuals on a personal level, on a their policies, than ever before, because there's so many more news sources that are out there. I mean, it's just, I remember when I was in college, I was kind of a geek, and I had the local paper mailed to my dorm room so I could keep up with what was going on back home. Well, you know, now you just hop on the internet and you get an RSS feed and it's in your inbox or it's in your reader. And so it's so much easier to gain information. The flip side of that is it's also easier to only get the information that reinforces what you believe or doesn't really stretch you or disagree with you. And so that, so you have this factor that I think tugs at the public. So you have, on the one hand, a lot more informed. They have deeper knowledge, but they're not maybe used to getting sort of the other side of the story. I mean, you know, you've got the New York Times editorial page and the Wall Street Journal editorial page on opposite sides, and not everybody reads both of those. And in Kentucky, there's no real counterpoint to the Courier Journal and Herald Leader editorial pages. So you have that information on the one hand. And then the other thing you have is, we have unemployment that's really high right now. We have a debt that's really high. There's not a lot of optimism going forward. These are going to change real far into the future, in the near future. And so this creates some tension for every American as they look at these issues. And so the pocketbook issues, the bedroom issues, whatever you want to describe it, I think maybe take on a little more meaning right now because of the tough times in which we live. So I don't, again, I think the public is, I believe we have to believe in them. That's the system we've set up. It's a democratic republic. But there's certainly some things that are different today than 10 years ago, for example.
Can I add one thing to this? Jasmine raised an incredibly important point, and that was the historical perspective that we consider this topic in. I worked on Capitol Hill in the 70s, and I worked for a moderate Republican named Marlo Cook, senator from Kentucky. And at that time,
who else did you work with? Mitch McConnell, right?
And Mitch, well, yeah, and Mitch. Yeah, Mitch and I were political.
Oh, the irony is thick.
Yeah, real thick. And back then, in the Republican Party, just in the Senate, you had everybody from Jacob Javits and Ed Brooke and Mark Hatfield from Oregon and Bob Packwood, who would today be as liberal as it gets, to Barry Goldwater and Strom Thurmond and you name it. I mean, that was in one party. On the Democratic side, you had Ted Kennedy, and you had Hubert Humphrey and Fritz Mondale and a lot of classic liberals. And then you had John Stennis and Russell Long and a lot of Dixiecrats who are as conservative as in today's world as you could get. So you had the entire range of philosophical spectrum in both parties, which meant you always had people working together across lines depending on the issue. That doesn't exist today. Right. And that's a huge difference in terms of helping the American people figure out who the sides are and what they mean.
And is that leading to, I'm going to use a bad term here, bomb throwing by both sides in the media, blogs, everything else? Because the reason I'm asking that is I get Time Magazine, and there's a Time Magazine, Gun Speech Madness, Where Do We Go from Arizona? And in it they asked a number of different folks, if you hadn't read it, what they thought about the public discourse, political discourse in this country, is it leading to violence? That was essentially the question. And the guy that's the founder of the Daily Kos, which is a very liberal blog, wrote, when Glenn Beck spreads the latest insane conspiracy theory, well, then it's only a matter of time before people start getting killed. Is that civil discourse by the Daily Kos founder? Or is that throwing bombs to just incite the other side? And maybe incite folks.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's throwing bombs. And I know a lot of the folks in the media, thank you, first of all, for covering and being in the media. But that being said, I mean, Kos is a good example of this. I mean, of somebody who has gotten notoriety from this that style. And, what was interesting is he was one who Gabby didn't vote for Nancy Pelosi for speaker. And Kos, I forget what he said, but it was a really coarse criticism of her went over the top. And so he's done it, he does it on both, he'll do it to Democrats too. I mean, that's just his style. And I don't find that to be particularly productive to what we're trying to accomplish in Washington.
Go ahead, Jasmine.
Well, we have to ask, why is it good business to elevate conflict? And who is it good business for? It is good business to sell newspapers, and I'm one of the few who still buys them. And it is good business for cable news and their advertisers to elicit these emotional responses. But we have to also remember that elections are very expensive. And it's good business for political activists to say that every day is a new emergency. Are you on any email lists where somebody emails you every day with a fresh emergency? Before President Obama even nominated his first Supreme Court justice, interest groups on both sides had already sent out their fundraising letters about why that person should be supported or opposed. So the question is, why do we allow elites, and I don't mean that in the traditional term, I just mean that the people in the media, in activist circles on both sides, and even among our representatives who need the differences to prove who they are and who they oppose, why do we as the citizens allow that unless it actually does represent our differences?
We not only allow it, we actually subsidize it. Because if, when Joe Wilson said, "You lie," during the State of the Union message last year, within the next 48 hours, he'd raised $1 million. When Alan Grayson, our nut job.
No relation. Google alerts have not been fun. So, right. Well, actually, they're better now that he lost. But
But when he went down on the floor, as he did frequently, and said the Republican health care plan is die and die quickly, he raised about $1 million in a week. So some politicians have figured out that the more outrageous, the more bombs you throw, the better you do financially.
Yeah, Michelle Bachmann on the Republican side. Hasn't had any, I don't think, equivalent to the "you lie" comment, but has known as a bomb thrower, and she raised more money than any Republican member of Congress last year, over $7 million for a congressional race.
Well, go ahead, Jasmine.
I was just asking, under those circumstances, is it appropriate to blame the voters who reward at the ballot box people who are creating an atmosphere that is perhaps unhelpful to those same voters?
And Congressman Grayson lost. But Congressman Wilson
won. It's a fair question.
Yeah.
Do all of us that are just voters that are not in elective office and are not in the media anymore, do we share the blame, or should we take the blame for rewarding candidates and for going to blogs and for going to TV talk shows and listening to radio talk shows that amp up the level of bitterness and conflict? Are we the ones to blame because we're buying it, essentially?
Well, I mean, I think everybody's to blame. We're all to blame. We all play, whether it's an elected official, the media, or the general public, we all are playing a role in this. So I don't, if you're phrasing it, is the public ultimately blamed? No, I wouldn't say that. But I think everybody's part of this problem. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's fair just to say it's ultimately the public's fault. Because I think as leaders, we're supposed to, there's this tension with leadership. I mean, most people believe leadership is taking a group of people who somewhere where they wouldn't otherwise go. And so sometimes elected officials, we're sheep sometimes. We sort of just we're the sheep that gets in the front. But there ought to be more of us who try to lead and take those folks in a place that they might otherwise not go. But they do ultimately follow, so it's ultimately their decision.
Do you think Mitch McConnell will ever call out Glenn Beck, or John Yarmuth will ever call out the Bill Maher and say, you know what he just said is really stupid, and from our side, that they shouldn't say something like that? Should there be more politicians calling out their own folks who agree with them in the media and saying, you shouldn't have said that? And if, I don't want to say blood on your hands, but if this sparks some action by someone, it's blood on your hands.
Well, you see it sometimes, but I'll give you a good example of where, I forget what she said, but Sarah Palin said something in the aftermath of the Tucson that Tim Pawlenty had a criticism. Tim Pawlenty was the governor of Minnesota until this year, and he's running for, he will run for president. He's not officially announced it yet. And he had a slight criticism of Sarah Palin, and a day or two later, he kind of took it back because of the blowback, because he wants to be president. I admired what he said because he was right when he said it. And he didn't have to, and what he said was respectful. It was respectful criticism. It's a shame to see somebody do that. But he did stick his neck out. He did say it. And I guess that's some level of progress. That we're going to have to do more of that. We're going to have to call out more of our own side and say, no, you're wrong on this one. Not just members of the media. I mean, our colleagues, too.
John?
Well, there was a perfect example. Yes, We ought to do that. There are things all the time where I think Ed Schultz goes way over the top and totally outrageous and misstates things. And I've been on his program, and I think I probably ought to call him out more. Keith Olbermann's gone now, so Rachel Maddow never makes a mistake, so I would never criticize her. But you've seen it. You saw it yesterday, where on Eric Cantor, the majority leader in the House now, was on Meet the Press, and David Gregory kept trying to get him just to shout down, just to say, "Are the birthers crazy?" And he hedged and hawed and said, "I wouldn't," you know, basically ended up saying, "I believe he's a United States citizen." That's all he would say. Mm-hmm. So no, our leaders, both parties, have to do that. You know, Nancy. The other day, Nancy Pelosi, when Steve Cohen, my friend from Memphis, made the comments he did on the floor about the big lie and Goebbels and
what did he say?
He was on the floor, I think, Wednesday night, and just in a freewheeling discussion about healthcare reform, and said, you know, what the Republicans do is they come up with the big lie, like government takeover or death panels, and they repeat it over and over and over, like Goebbels did. Goebbels, the propaganda minister for the Nazi Germany, you know, who taught, that was, you know, the big lie. And he was roundly chastised, and Nancy called him out on it personally, just said, "Get over here. That's not what you should be doing." So we do it a little bit. We don't often do it in public. Mm-hmm. And
that's the difference, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the difference.
It does happen in private.
Yeah.
And also, there are now more media outlets where you can sort of do things. Joe Gersh sitting over there, and Bruce Schreiner. Bruce is with the AP, and Joe's with the CJ. They can't write columns like this or stories like this where they have a lot of confidential sources. But now there are publications that are reputable that'll write more, and you can get out there that this sort of, you know, hand slapping took place. But it doesn't happen very often with the name on the record. You know, you rarely will see a Republican elected official ever criticize Sarah Palin publicly. But there's been loads of articles of criticizing her privately.
Go ahead, Jasmine.
Can I add that back to the 70s? I think that it's a good point to say that there was a time when the parties were more diverse and the people within them were more ideologically different. But on the other hand, I think I lose some patience when I hear about the good old days where people argued on the floor and then went out to dinner together. Because then what do those positions mean? I'm not certainly endorsing that it should become so personal, but why isn't it the case that parties have crystal clear differences that the average busy person who's trying to do a lot of other things can simply use that cue, which is the most important cue we have, to divide people into those who would be a good representative for my interests and those who won't? In the confusing old days, although it was probably more civil, that kind of diversity muddied the waters, and it created the cry for third parties, because the assumption was that the two-party system was so confusing with Southern conservative Democrats, Northern liberal Democrats, Northern liberal Republicans, and so forth, that maybe we need a multi-party system to satisfy different needs. I think that most of us today would fall into one of the two parties. So can we keep the differences without icing the cake with all of these extra vicious and divisive tactics?
Well, Jim Coyle, who's out in the audience, he's a community member, brought up what you said in your opening. He said, "Do you really believe that this discourse is worse now than any other time in American politics?" And I think what you're saying is, no, the discourse between the politicians may not be different, but that the level and the media outlets and the opportunity to spread quickly is that a fair assessment or not?
Well, when people vote, they vote for a lot of reasons, and they vote based on a lot of reasons. And the number one cue is the party system. So most people, even if you stray a little bit, you have a pretty set idea of what the two parties believe in and where you fit in. Now, it's obviously possible to evolve over time, and many people do. It's also possible to stray on any one vote, and our ballots allow that we can have divided government, we can vote for different parties for different reasons. But again, can we have the differences that we need to make decisions, to tell our representatives what we believe in, and make sure those differences are communicated, but not become so divisive that becomes the story?
And Kentucky's kind of a unique state, because if you look at our voter registration, most people live in a community that is really one side or the other. You know, in the aggregate, it's about 1.5 to 1, about 3 to 2 registered Democrat to registered Republican, although ideologically probably doesn't fall in those same lines. But But most counties in Kentucky are one way or another. And they've kind of been locked in that way for a long time. We also have a straight ticket option, which is something that only about 12 states have left, where you can vote straight ticket. But over time, it seems we're using that less often. And I think as more counties have a paper ballot where you still have to go on a machine, if you hit straight ticket, automatically filled it all in on a paper ballot, you still see the races and you have to skip over them. And I think people break the straight ticket more often in those kinds of with those kinds of ballots. But it's, and you know, we had an interesting history of this. And every state official has to take an oath in which we swear not to have committed a duel or even served as a second in a duel, which is a gentlemanly way of violence, but it was still violent. And we've been doing that for 100 years. So I think to the questioner's point, this has kind of gone on for a while. But I think one of the unique things about the state is some of the local level, we tend to have intra-party fights more so than mm-hmm. party-to-party fights.
Jasmine raised a very interesting point, and I'm going to give another side of it, and that is that parties basically have become proxies for policy. And they help the voters make a decision without doing the hard work. That's really dangerous for society. Those of you who may have seen Bill Maher's show a week ago when James Carville was on, anybody see that? He went through this list of things that the Republicans have now become passionately against. And he called every one of them was a Republican policy. Cap and trade, the health care bill, which is basically Romney's health care plan from Massachusetts, Milton Friedman's monetary policy, the individual mandate was a health insurance was a Republican idea. He went through five or six things. Now the Republicans are passionately against them. They were all Republican ideas. And so it's the cheap way out. It's the easy way out to citizenship to say that, okay, well, I guess they're right because that's the Republicans, or they're right because that's the Democrats. There's a fascinating book out, I don't know if you read it, called Opinion Makers. It was written by a guy named David Moore, who's worked for Gallup polling organization for 15 years, was an executive with Gallup, and talked about all the faults and the flaws in public policy questioning. And the bottom line was, and he's not talking about election polling, he's talking about whether they're for you or for against healthcare reform, blah, blah, blah. Because the media companies and the polling companies have paired up, they are trying to produce conflict because otherwise the polls aren't interesting. So they force voters into decisions in these polls which don't reflect either their real opinion or their knowledge. And the classic example was they asked in a poll one time, are you in favor of drilling for oil in Anwar? And it was 50-40, the reported result was 50-47 with 3% undecided. Then they went back and asked those same people, do you know where Anwar is? 87% did not know where it was, and 85% did not know what any of the initials in ANWR
Alaska
stood for.
Alaska National Wildlife Refuge.
Yeah. And his point was that people are really not very knowledgeable about these issues, and it's not a knock on people. Again, they're pretty complicated issues. You'd have to spend an awful lot of time understanding what was in the health care reform bill. I guarantee you, because I spent 5 or 6 hours a day for a year. So the polling there is not useful. Republicans, all they had to do was call it Obamacare, and they got the response they wanted, which was the people who believe they are on balance on their side said, I'm against health care reform, even though in many, many cases, it helped them immeasurably. So,
I think most people, that are probably here would say that public discourse is at a worse level than when we grew up. At least that's our perception, at least. Jasmine, I think you sort of disagreed with that. But I would say most of us, I suspect, that are out here in the room probably are here because we think that it's gotten a little bit down and dirty. The question, I think, out of the shooting in Arizona is this level of discourse, whether it's worse or better than it was 50 years ago, is it leading to violence, and is it prompting people who are mentally ill or are so set in their beliefs that they can't see another way to go out and take some sort of violent action, or maybe not total violence, but some adverse reaction against politicians, the media, other folks? Is it prompting
I think that maybe Grayson and I are not quite old enough to remember the 60s, but we've heard about them, and they were pretty violent. And I was told that my first forced viewing on television were the Watergate hearings and then Roots, but I didn't have anything in between. So I think that the question is, why do we have political amnesia in this country? When presidents and ex-presidents get to market their memoirs before the dust has settled on the policies that they divided the country on, I think that other societies around the world teach their children by memorization to hate certain people because they did something bad to us 2,000 years ago, or there's a date, there's a time, there was a battle. I think there were civil wars, maybe in Yugoslavia, built on some of those principles. We don't do that. We have a very positive look. We look ahead. We look back fondly, and I think that Haley Barbour has been getting in trouble for that, too. I don't know why we don't acknowledge that we have had political violence in this country. We have had terrible divisions. The New Deal was called socialist and fascist when those words meant something. And yet we think back that that was a wonderful consensus moment. It wasn't. So why not acknowledge that we have political processes that largely contain political differences, but they don't always, and that this might not be that different from those experiences, and in fact, it might be milder under some views.
You buy that?
Well, I think I buy that in the isolated idea. I buy that. Put it in the context of modern society where you have access to media, and media have access to you that is, in most cases, unfiltered, unedited, unvetted. You have 24/7 news coverage. You have access to unbelievable firepower. A lot of things raise the stakes of that kind of dialogue because of other things, again, the media, the internet, and weaponry. So I made a statement right after the shooting, I think the next day or so forth, and I said it's a shame that the Tea Party is actually being blamed for this, partially because, and I think they're being blamed for it just because they are the latest memory of kind of this outrageous dialogue and bringing guns to rallies and so forth. People thought I was blaming the Tea Party. I was actually not. I was just saying that's because, you know, I remember going back. I wrote columns for weeks and weeks after the 2000 election, which I called President Bush occupant. I didn't refer him to him as a president. And, you know, so and Bush was called tyrant and dictator, and that's less than 10 years ago. So we do have a perspective issue.
Right.
But
and
again,
also,
I think the other stuff has made it a little more, the stakes are higher.
Right, but also I think there was an opinion piece in the Courier Journal over the weekend by Mark Rudd, who was a weatherman, and he talked about his mentality as a member of the weather underground when bombs exploded because liberals were trying to blow up military installations. I went to the University of Wisconsin, as Mark mentioned, and there are buildings that are so confusing on the campus because they were literally designed to be terrorist-proof because the University of Wisconsin had terrorist bombings. We haven't seen that on college campuses. So the question was, it's a more broad question.
That was knocking on wood.
Oh, good. Startled me.
Yeah.
The question is, under what circumstances can differences be contained in the normal political system, and under what circumstances is the normal political system unable to deal with people's emotional differences, especially in a time of high anxiety? We have economic anxiety. We have social anxiety. These are not necessarily black and white issues, as the congressman said earlier, but why is it so easy for us to see them as black or white issues? Is it indicative that we have arrived at a moment in our history that we have seen before where regular politics is just not enough?
To answer your specific question, I don't think that the violence, that we're going to see a violent outcome, and I think I would agree with Jasmine about the, you know, what I read about the 60s in my history classes.
Because you're not old enough.
Because I'm not old enough, right.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, welcome. I would also, you know, I still remember the ad that MoveOn.org purchased in the New York Times. It said, "General Petraeus," for General Petraeus. And so, like I said, I think both sides of, it's kind of like whoever is in power, the out of power is the one that sort of, in the last few years, seems to have gotten a little bit out of kilter. And as I said in my opening statement, and what Jasmine just said, I think that the economic situation we're in, and politics does appear to be broken in Kentucky and in Washington, and I think that's frustrating people a lot. I don't think it's going to frustrate them enough to go to violence, but I think it's frustrating them, they deserve to be frustrated by it, frankly.
Tomorrow night, State of the Union address, the Republicans and Democrats are going to hold hands and sing Kumbaya and sit next to each other during the speech, correct?
Some will.
Some will. What are you going to do?
Well, I'm actually trying to figure that out. The way the seating works at the State of the Union is, the senators have seats in the front. It's held in the House chamber. The senators have seats in the front, along with the Supreme Court. We all sit in a first-come, first-serve basis. You just go down there and plant yourself. So it requires an awful lot of organization that's hard to do in that kind of setting because, you know, you might say, let's, there are four of us, two Democrats, two Republicans, let's go sit together, and then you can't find four seats together. So there's going to, I know.
It's easier for the senators, is what you're saying.
It's easier for the senators. Yeah. I know the leadership is going to sit with each other. Steny Hoyer, who's the minority whip, and Kevin McCarthy are going to sit together, and they've worked out some one-on-one things like that. There's some states whose delegations are going to sit together. They're going to try to sit together. So we're going to.
But whenever you see it on TV, it's always the Democrats over here and the Republicans over here. If it's a Republican president, he says something great, the Republicans all stand up and clap. The Democrats are sitting on their hands.
Right. Tomorrow. Both parties have been admonished about that.
So there is now, it's obviously that Congress has figured out that the American people don't like this level of discourse, whether it's better or worse, whatever. But coming out of the shootings in Arizona, Congress has figured this out. Question is, how long will it last, and is this just a show?
If history is any guide, it will last about a month. And what we're going to see, I think, unfortunately, I mean, it would be nice to have this era of good feelings laid out for the next 2 years, is there going to be some incredibly polarized debates in the next 2 months, notably over spending cuts and the debt ceiling. And there are serious differences between the parties. These are go-to-the-wall issues. It's unfortunate that we're going to have go-to-the-wall issues so
right
soon.
Yeah.
So I suspect that it's going to dissolve pretty quickly. Although I still think the words will be more carefully chosen. I don't think you're going to have anybody except maybe Michelle Bachmann. And fortunately for that perspective, Alan Grayson's gone from our side. But Anthony Weiner's still there. So we've got, yeah. I mean, you've got a few outliers. I think beyond them, the tone will be very different and the words used will be very different. We won't be challenging, as Michelle Bachmann has done, the patriotism or the un-Americanism of people from the other party. It will be much more policy related, I think.
I watched the healthcare debate a little bit. Didn't it seem to be a little bit more civil, more policy oriented? Obviously, there's a big gulf in the positions, but it seemed like that debate was more civil, although that was a debate where everybody knew the outcome, whereas the debt ceiling and the deficit cut, the debt cut, the spending cuts, that outcome is not as clear. Oh, well, I mean, I think the ceiling will be raised, but the rest of it has. And you have this presidential race, which John didn't mention.
Right. Exactly.
We have the presidential race, which appears to be starting a little bit later on the Republican side, and it's not clear whether you're going to have, you know, maybe Senator Thune's going to run. It's not clear, maybe Mike Pence, but it's not clear that you're going to have a lot of members of Congress actually campaigning, but the party will. The party will want to carry the water a little bit as part of that debate. So we'll have to see how that plays out. It's unfortunate timing where you have a divided government 2 years before a presidential election to really kind of work together.
Go ahead, Jasmine.
Well, to me, I want to echo Congressman and Secretary Grayson's comments by talking about the State of the Union, because to me, the interesting visual is not the audience, but actually behind the president, because we're going to see a Democratic vice president over one shoulder and Speaker Boehner, the newly elected Republican leader, on the other. Why do we as voters behave that way? We've had three volatile elections in a row. 2006 was volatile, 2008 was volatile, and 2010 was volatile. Not in a violent sense, but in the sense that change happened again, again, and again. does that indicate that we are at a wall where the problems are going to be very difficult to solve? And the more important question for the State of the Union, in addition to the strange visual that reminds us what we have chosen, is the question of policy. If we are too wrapped up in the media in dealing with how we speak to each other, how will we understand the deficit? The deficit is more complicated than Anwar. And it is very important that people understand why we are at this moment in our history where the deficit is not only straining our economy, but it is straining the assumption that the debt ceiling will be raised. Now, what's interesting is, in my line of study, that why is it that the two branches have punted a lot of these questions to a deficit commission? Because if they are not able to handle the issues of the day through normal processes and punting them out, essentially outsourcing representation to other commissions, then where are we as a society? I think it goes in a completely different direction from the violence question. It is a substantive question that we have reached a crossroads in the United States where representation and regular politics are simply not sufficient to solve the pressing problems of the country.
Can I just say?
Yeah, I'm surprised we didn't get more applause on that.
Jasmine mentioned the Independent Commission, and those of you, some of you may have heard me talk about this before the election and immediately afterwards, but I said my one hope for a better dialogue in this country was the Independent Commission, because I said, yeah, I hope that it gave us the opportunity to have these very serious, important discussions outside of a partisan environment. And unfortunately, and it was our leadership who did it, as soon as the first report came out, our leadership said,
no.
Non-starter, dead on arrival. Which was totally irresponsible. I called Nancy Pelosi the next day. I said, Madam Speaker, with all due respect, that's not where we need to be. We need to have these discussions. You can't just, anyway, didn't do any good.
Yeah, it was interesting because the Republicans reacted more favorably. You know, Senator Tom Coburn, who's one of the most conservative members in the United States Senate, voted for it, even though it had some tax increases in it, which made me feel pretty good. But unfortunately, yeah, it seems like its moment has passed. Although I do think we're certainly better off from having had that discussion and having a bipartisan group look at how enormous this problem is and produce a document that may not get used, but it definitely raised the awareness of how hard this is going to be to solve.
It gave the American people a sense of what our options are, what our choices are, and that's often what we don't get.
Okay. All right. I've got a few questions up here. Let's run through these real quick. If you can give some soundbite answers in 9 seconds, 9.8 seconds, that'd be great.
You got your stopwatch ready?
No, I don't have my stopwatch. Just kidding. This is from Michael Anthony. He's from the communities from Sellersburg, Indiana. He says, how do bills such as Senate Bill 6 in the Kentucky legislature, which mirrors the Arizona immigration bill, affect civility in public discourse and action?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the problems I have with Senate Bill 6, and I haven't said this publicly because nobody's asked me, is that it didn't have the money, the cost attached to it. You know, on the one hand, the Senate was passing a bill requiring bills to be up posted for 48 hours. This is state Senate, by the way, for 48 hours. And then when they passed this thing before we analyzed how much it was going to cost, which basically, if you were following, would told you that this was all about politics. This wasn't about the substance of the issue, because you can make a case that something like Senate Bill 6 might be needed in Kentucky in a sober way, but just slamming it through the way it was done showed it was about politics. And I was disappointed in that because there was another bill that was held back in that group of the first week. That being said, I think what the state Senate did by having bills actually pass the first week and having an agenda, I applaud that because it does make it clearer to the public what the state Senate's agenda is. If you don't like it, you can vote against them. Or you can be for it. And so I think that going back to Jasmine's point, some of this can be kind of clarifying in a way. But that particular bill and how it played out, that disappointed me.
So I guess the question, Michael, are you here? Where are you? So what were you trying to get at? Whether the immigration issue is such a hot button issue, how does that impact?
Well, it was plain politics. It was plain politics, pure and simple. And I think any argument that you could, that's what I say, I think trying to make the argument that we really need this bill in Kentucky, you undermine that by shoving it through without the fiscal impact.
Okay. All right.
Next. There's a Republican calling out Republicans, which I guess is why I'm going to academia.
This is from Allison Smith. She's a student. This is back on the State of the Union address. She asked, the Tea Party Caucus will be giving an additional response to the State of the Union address besides the traditional Republican response. Do you think this will increase political partisanship? Jasmine?
Well, I think the Tea Party is misnamed because it's not a party, it's a faction of a party. And again, this goes back to our two-party problem, which is great at creating majorities that can govern, but is not necessarily great at creating unanimity within the party. So what we've seen is a Republican civil war, which has been done on both sides. The Democrats had one too, if you remember the Carter administration. So Democrats argue with Democrats, and Republicans argue with Republicans. So the question then is, which faction within a party rises to the top and gets to set the agenda, gets to set the strategy of the next election cycle? And what we saw recently was that liberal, if there is such a thing, Republicans don't exist anymore the way they used to. And the question is that good or bad for the Republican Party? That is a very interesting and separate question. Republicans might argue that the last election cycle showed some gains, but also some losses. So there will be a continued soul searching within the party for the meaning of the agenda. And that's a good example. To have two responses to the State of the Union would say to me right away that this is not a party at peace with itself going into the next election cycle.
John?
Well, Michelle Bachmann's going to deliver the Tea Party response, which by definition makes it a much more provocative atmosphere. Paul Ryan, who's going to deliver the party's response, mainstream party's response, is very, very conservative. He's a very smart, thoughtful guy. I happen to think he's wrong on a lot of things, but he will be an impressive representative of the party. Michelle will illustrate what's out there on the extreme. And so I don't think it's going to help. And it's not going to enhance civility, let's put it that way.
Well, by calling her extreme, aren't you feeding into the whole public discourse problem?
Well, see, I don't know about that. And this is, I think, goes back to Jasmine's initial comments about, and Trey's, we can't lose our passion, we can't lose our principles. If I think Mitch McConnell's lying to my constituents, I'm going to call him a liar. And I think that's fair, and I don't think it crosses a line. And ultimately, this is about drawing lines. I mean, it's all about drawing lines. And so I don't think we ever want to lose that. But to call her, actually, I think probably policy-wise, Paul Ryan is more extreme than Michelle is. Michelle is just a very polarizing, incendiary person. She just does that, just like Anthony Weiner does it on our side.
Trey, do you want to weigh in, or?
I mean, I feel like I should because it's a Republican, but I don't know. I don't really have much to
That's
add.
Fine.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm not dodging it.
I'm out of questions from you folks. So yeah. If you've got some Hope or Nick or anybody, if you've got some questions, Let's feed him up
John,
front here.
Mark, there's one there in the gentleman with the blue.
Well, I was going to take him in written form, but that's okay. I'll tell you what. Let me
shout it out, and you can repeat it.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
Not telling you how to do it, but
here's a microphone right here. We've got about half an hour or so. If you want to just ask him.
my name's Ken Stammerman. This question is actually directed at John. Summer, a year ago, you had a town hall meeting at Central High. Would you ever do a town hall meeting again, given that experience?
It's a good question. It's a very good question.
Actually, I had one of the best times of my life that night. You can't imagine what it feels like to go out on a stage with 1,700 people there, half of whom or more are after your throat, and try to be challenged intellectually like that. It was an incredible evening, and I thought actually the crowd was pretty well behaved under the circumstances, with all the hype that surrounded that and surrounded the debate around the country. I didn't think the questions were unfair. Yeah, the people screamed a little bit, but I really didn't think it was that. I thought it was a great event. I thought it was a phenomenal event, and I would do it again. I'd probably be more likely to do it now than I was then. And I just, you know, thinking about the fact that Francine moderated that was, again, an example of when you can cooperate and in a way that advances the discussion. I thought we had a good discussion that night. I don't think the questions, again, were outrageous. I think they were largely policy-based. Nobody called me a communist that I can remember, at least that I heard.
Not your face.
not that I heard. So, I'd do them again.
So even after what happened in Arizona, and this may be putting you on the spot a little bit here, but there have been some concerns about security, not just by you, but by other people in Congress. Are you going to demand that do you have security at each one of your public forums, or?
Well, we actually had security at, we had lots of security at that event. We probably had 15 uniformed officers there, maybe more than that. And we had it at Central High School so we could actually ban weapons, although I don't think we actually had, there may have been one or two that we actually had to deal with. One of the things that I think all of us in Congress realized, probably for the first time, after Gabby was shot, is that, you know, we all understand that that can happen. It's in the back of all of our minds, and that's kind of, we signed up for that. What I don't think anybody had really focused on was the responsibility we have to the people whom we attract. And when people come out to see us, we do have a responsibility to provide for their safety. And so what we've done now is basically work with law enforcement to say when there's an event like this one in which where it has been announced that I'm going to be there, advertised, whatever, that we'll make sure that there's some security present. I don't have anybody driving around with me or going to Kroger with me, but but that, and I think that's a kind of a prudent thing to do and also a reasonable way to approach it. But,
okay, good question.
It was a good question.
Jasmine, do you want to weigh in?
Well, I just wanted to ask the congressman whether or not he sees a representative slice of his constituents at these types of events. Because on the one hand, while we don't like extremism of any type, we have to admit that the people who follow your whereabouts are probably knowledgeable. And knowledge sometimes brings extreme to the table, whereas when I'm teaching college students, the stereotype is that college students are not as interested or informed, which I disagree with. But the question is, how far are we going to go? To actually go to an event, to know your schedule, takes a certain amount of engagement. So who is the cross-section of that typical audience at any type of constituency event?
Well, they are people who are much more engaged and knowledgeable, exactly. And one of the reasons, we were doing a lot of the Congress on Your Corner events, like the one Gabby did, and we stopped doing them. Security was an element of our decision, but the smallest element. What we found out was people were coming out to use those events as a forum for advertising their own position, advocating their own position, so they were disruptive, and they were kind of defeating the purpose that we had, which were people coming to see us because they wanted to make their point of view known on a one-to-one basis, or they had a problem with the government they wanted us to help them with. So they were these other people who were, again, very much engaged. These are the type of people you want in democracy. They weren't violent, they were just engaged. We're kind of being disruptive, and which happened to a lot of those town hall meetings back in August of 2009. So, it's a tough decision. This is exactly what the kind of democracy you want. And that's what was so tragic about that event, that this was the epitome of the essence of democracy, and somebody decided to turn it into a shooting gallery.
Trey, this may be a good question for you, since you were running for U.S. Senate. This is from Ron Vogel, who's a faculty member here. He says, is the problem civil discourse, or is it the need for gun control? Have at it.
No, I think the problem is civil discourse. I mean, I've been pretty clear from the beginning, and I think most people have, that what happened in Arizona is a tragedy and was not was the result of a troubled mind. I got asked this on one of the news shows last week. I mean, I'm sure we'll have a gun control debate in the Congress, or in the, if not the Congress, in the public, over the next year. Peggy Noonan, who writes for the Wall Street Journal, and who was President, one of Reagan's former speechwriters, Saturday in her column in the Journal called for banning the magazine, the extra long magazines for those for guns, and she thought that that would be something that she didn't think the Republican Party would go to the mat to defeat. And it'll be interesting to see, though, given that she's conservative and is a Republican and opined on that, what kind of position, what kind of debate you have. Again, we're going into a presidential election year. I don't know that any Republican presidential candidate is going to do anything other than say, no, you know, Second Amendment means what it says. But I think that discussion will definitely take place.
Okay.
I hope it does. I'm a co-sponsor of the bill that Trey referred to. It's Carolyn McCarthy's bill. Actually, Dick Cheney actually said publicly that he thought that that was probably a good idea, which was stunning. I really don't think there will be a discussion in Congress, unfortunately. At least I don't think there's going to be one on the House side. I hope there is.
That's true. I guess in the House you can't have that discussion.
The majority agrees to it.
Yeah.
So I don't anticipate we'll have it. But you know what was, there were three elements to the Tucson tragedy. One was guns, one was mental health, the three issues that have come from it, and then the possibility that something triggered in Jared Loeffner the idea of going to shoot a government official. And we ought to debate all of those and the intersection of the three. As I made a speech on the floor the other day, I said, you know, it's politically correct right now to say, oh, he was a madman acting on his own. And I said, that's kind of the easy way out. Because the fact is, he did target a member of Congress. He didn't go after the military that rejected him, the community college that threw him out, the five employers who had fired him, or his family from whom he was ostracized. He didn't choose any of them. He went after Gabby. And we need to try to figure out why. My guess is that through whatever means, he had become focused on this nihilist anti-government attitude, and she was the symbol of government. And I don't think it was personal. I don't think it was philosophical, other than the fact that he was trying to destroy government. But anyway, those three elements clearly intersected in a very tragic way. They can intersect again, and we need to discuss all of them.
Another question out there. I'll tell you what. Where's Sarah? Where's Sarah that sent the question up here? I don't really understand it. Could you just explain your question? Go ahead.
I wanted to know, and this is a little bit contrary to maybe what you've been talking about, Dr. Ferrier particularly, but I guess I've read some articles that talk about de-alignment of political parties as opposed to increased participation or polarization, and I kind of want to know what your take is on that. Is this an actual trend, and if it's valid, how do you see that affecting the current political discourse?
More independent voters, is that what you're getting at?
Well, party polarization is easy to track, actually. One example that the congressman would be familiar with is, what are the lineups on the House and Senate floor? Do Democrats stick with Democrats and Republicans with Republicans? And this is an unequivocal trend. There is greater polarization on the floors of the House and Senate than there were decades ago, which brings up your earlier remark that there was more diversity within the parties at that time. So that is real. That is a measure of polarization. Another measure of polarization is through public opinion polling, where the average person, hopefully most of us in the room, are also polled on similar questions. Are we more divided than we used to be? And here the evidence is actually pretty complicated. And there are debates within political science that I won't bore you with, but the essential question is, who's driving polarization? There's a legitimate question there. Is it from the voters? Or is it from the representatives themselves and other activists in the political environment who are ratcheting it up for their own purposes? So, but to answer your question, increased polarization is very real. It also has to do with the realignment of the parties. As many of you know, in your lifetimes, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party have changed completely, and that's largely due to the white South. The Democratic Party was the party of the South, and some of the diversity within the Democratic Party had to do with the North-South split. Once most of the white Southerners went to the Republican Party after Goldwater in 1964, the Republican Party changed because of that, so did the Democratic Party. What was left were a lot of differences between them, and Republicans became more like Republicans, and Democrats became more like Democrats. A structural issue, though, is how we draw our districts, and this is something that will come up with the census. Senators represent states, but House districts are drawn by the state legislatures. Are House districts drawn to create diversity in those districts, or are they drawn to bring out a natural or unnatural homogeneity or a sameness within those districts? Because if House members who are Republicans represent really, really Republican districts and Democrats represent really, really Democratic districts, well, no wonder the House would be polarized. But senators are a little bit more complicated as they represent whole states.
If I could, and a couple other just sort of election-related trends. One of the things we do see, even in a state like Kentucky, which has a very small percentage of independent or third-party registrants, we do see a slight uptick, especially among first-time registrants, you know, voters under the age of 25 or under the age of 30. We see a little bit higher number of independents or third-party registration in Kentucky, nowhere near what you see in other states. Mm-hmm. And again, that goes back to what I said earlier about so many of our counties are one-party rural, and so you're driven to want to pick a party so you can vote in that primary, and then you pick who you want in the fall. Where I live up in northern Kentucky, Democrats the Republican primary settles pretty much everything at the local level, so when in doubt, you choose Republican. It's different in, you know, Elliott County, where Rocky Atkins, who's the Democratic majority leader, is from. There's like five Republicans there. So, but we do see this overall, and if you look at sort of the national level, you see a lot more folks choosing to not register as one party or another, especially in states that have a more open primary. You know, some states, South Carolina, for example, you don't actually register as a member of a political party. You just pick the primary when it comes time to vote. And now that is recorded, so the parties have a trend. All right, this person always votes in the Republican primary. I'm going to target this particular voter. But you don't have. You can go by year. You can't go race by race, but you can go year by year. And so, for example, in Massachusetts, where Scott Brown got elected to the seat formerly held by Senator Kennedy, the independents are by far the second biggest party. And the Republicans are very, you know, it's in the teens in registration there. But yet Scott Brown was able to win because he took those independents, put them with the Republicans, and got to, you know, 51-52% of the vote. So I think we are seeing a little bit, especially among younger voters, lack a little bit less attachment to the party. And then, I'll, you know, my own experience is kind of fascinating because I essentially ran on the Republican Party platform and Rand disagreed on several issues with the party platform, even ran an ad criticizing me describing the Republican Party platform on one particular issue. He won for a lot of reasons. We can have another forum for another day to talk about that. But I thought that was kind of interesting that I was more the platform guy, which was ostensibly was what the party believed in 08. He ran to the right and frankly was probably better tuned to the Republican electorate in that cycle, which is why he
John,
won.
John, do you want to weigh in real quick?
Yeah, I'm a little, 2 points. One is I'm a little suspect of people self-identifying their allegiances. Because I think people, you ask somebody, are you an independent or Republican or Democrat? There is a natural inclination in some people to say, I'm an independent, you know, I'm an independent thinker, therefore I'm an independent, when they're really not. There's a guy named Drew Weston, who's a sociologist at Emory University, has written a book called The Political Brain, and he analyzed tens of thousands of election results and, you know, hundreds of elections and with colleagues, and I'll get this number slightly wrong, but he said his conclusion was that for almost 90% of the voters, their vote is predictable with 95% certainty before there's ever a candidate in the race, because they are wired in certain ways to make a political choice. And that was just an interesting perspective. So I think the notion of a truly independent voter is, I think, a little bit meaningless, but we'll see.
Well, if that's the case, then, yeah. And Jasmine may have a better idea than I would on this, or any of the rest of us would have on this, have we become, I mean, is Gallup polling or anything else shown that over the years, maybe in 1980 we had, say, you know, 20% folks that considered themselves moderates and could vote either way in a given election, and now it's only, you know, 5% or 10%. Have we gotten... Is the electorate so polarized that we're just seeking out folks that agree with us and not talking and not paying attention and listening to both sides of an issue? We're just going to listen to Rush Limbaugh, whatever he says, I agree with that, or I'm watching Bill Maher and whatever he says, I agree with that. Has that happened in our country, or is it not?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I'm at least old enough to remember that at 6 or 7 o'clock at night, we all watch the same nightly news program. Mm-hmm. That's a difference. Mm-hmm. So the news had to be a little bit more moderate when just about everybody was watching the same person. Yeah. But as far as polarization goes, it's interesting. Republicans have become more conservative, but Democrats have become more moderate. So if you ask a Democrat in a poll, are you a liberal Democrat or a moderate Democrat, the average Democrat would say moderate. If you ask a Republican, are you a moderate Republican or a conservative Republican, for a lot of reasons, the answer would be conservative. So as a nation, we seem polarized, but we are actually marching right, and we have been for decades. And the question is whether or not Reagan defined the era that we are in right now or not is open to debate, because we look at political and partisan realignments only backward, but the question was the 1980 election the defining election?
How in the world did we elect Barack Obama then if we've been
marching? Well, that's a good question. But keep in mind that President Obama has not said a word about gun control since the Tucson incident. He dropped the public option. He's not necessarily a liberal in his policies.
I think there's probably some folks out here that might disagree with you, but I don't know.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, after there's a window of opportunity to talk about a policy. There were a lot of people interested in how we gather intelligence before 9/11, but 9/11 provided an avenue or a window to discuss the policy in a new way. There were people who wanted to invade Iraq before 9/11, and that provided an avenue for a policy debate that was already taking place. After a major gun incident, it seems natural that politicians on both sides would have an open debate, but he has remained quite silent about the issue, and I don't think that people realize that that might be a political calculation as well, more so than a policy position.
If I go back to your question, I do think...
Are we more polarized? Well, you might know.
Well, no, I think John made a good point of the gentleman whose book the professor he talked about. I mean, I think that's important, but I also think back and some of the more recent Kentucky elections, and I don't want to say that the voters get everything right, but if you look at, you know, for example, my experiences in the statewide races, which aren't as ideological, I get that, but the voters went, you know, race by race, column by column, and, you know, 2003... They were able to distinguish among the Jack Woods of the world who were just not qualified. It was the Republican candidate for Attorney General. He just wasn't qualified to be Attorney General. And they, even though they were that year kind of mad at Democrats and were punished them, they were able to distinguish that. And I think in 2007, I'd like to think they distinguished that I was the better candidate, and that's why I was able to win, even though the top of the ticket, they went strongly with the Democrats. Yeah. And even Gabby. I mean, Gabby's... two toughest races, her 06 first win in this race right now, the Republican candidate was, we were weak Republican candidates. And the voters in her district who were, you know, it's arguably a Republican district, saw her and said, you know, I like her. She's more qualified. Yeah, I don't agree with her on every issue, but I agree with her on some, and she's certainly very accessible, and she's got a great personality. Mm-hmm. I'm going to vote for her. And we still see that on occasion throughout Kentucky and throughout America. So it does. That's again why, you know, the glass, which is now empty, I still say is half full, because you do see this happen, and it's not just a simple I'm always going to vote Republican or Democrat or whatever. We see that.
One other just book recommendation, since I'm flogging books up here. There's Bill Bishop, who used to write for the Herald Leader, in Lexington, a great guy, used to be here, wrote a book called The Big Sort. And it's actually a discussion of how we've sorted ourselves, not just in terms of politics, but in terms of churches and residential, where we live, what kind of subdivision we live in, the media we consume, even the way we shop. All of these things, his theory is, and it's a very compelling argument that he makes, is we've sorted ourselves by philosophy in many, many different ways in this country, which again can only exacerbate the polarization. Because if you create cities and districts in which, you know, you have an Austin, Texas sitting in the middle of the reddest state there is probably, and there's a reason for that. People, that's where Bill lives now. So it's not just going to the voting booth, it's in many different ways. And we've seen it particularly, I mean, you've got Highland Baptist Church here, which is very unlike most other Baptist churches here.
Let's get a quick answer on this one, then there were a couple of questions out of the crowd. It's kind of a loaded question, but I'm going to ask it anyways. This is from Kenya, who's a community member, who says, how much of this polarized climate and public discourse problem in our country, folks talking about we want our country back, has to do with the fact that we have an African-American president?
Okay. Can I start with that then?
Sure.
I'm old enough to remember when Bill Clinton was elected president, and I'm also old enough to remember when the internet was invented. And I sometimes like to amuse my students, if you Google how many people has Bill Clinton killed, websites come up. This is hard to imagine, that the statesman that we know as Bill Clinton today and his wife are these considered elder statespeople of the United States bringing us together. They were polarizing, they were hated, and he's white from Arkansas. That does not excuse racism against our current president. But again, as I said earlier, we forget all sorts of divisions very quickly. People did not like him. They were terrified of him. They saw him as the harbinger of a new world order. That was frightening. And if we're going to recommend things to read, I can give you an assignment. A famous political historian named Richard Hofstadter wrote a very famous article in 1964 called The Paranoid Style of American Politics. And the first line says, anger is common in American politics. The anger is based often on the fear that the world as they know it is about to end. We see this in the violence of the integration moments of the 50s and 60s. I show Eyes on the Prize to my students. They are shocked because either they don't know this political history or they're seeing it for the first time with their own eyes, that there was violence in the streets. And university students who are white are chanting, 2, 4, 6, 8, we don't want to integrate, yay. It's so bizarre to them to think that we've been through moments like this in the past. It is sometimes based on race, but it is sometimes based on fear. Fear that the world is literally slipping out of their hands. And that is a fear that can find expression in a lot of legitimate ways, but also, again, outside the system. So I don't want to discount racism against our president, but I just want to remind everybody that other presidents were loathed in their day as well, even ones we later considered great.
When President Obama actually got inaugurated, so on Inauguration Day, 2 months roughly after his election, his approval rating was extraordinarily high, which I think to me is a fact that sort of argues against this, a widespread racist feeling of this country. There were a lot of conservatives, a lot of Republicans who approved of him on day one. They wanted him to succeed because he's our president, and because he was the first African-American president, we wanted him to do very well. And then, you know, when he started governing, then they just disagreed on policy. But I think that racism moment is overblown. But I don't think it's fair to say it doesn't exist. It does certainly exist.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's an element of it. I think it's more xenophobia than it is racism.
Yeah, that's probably okay.
I mean, the immigration debate is part of the same dynamic, I think.
I think there was a lady in the back that had her hand up. Did you still have a question, ma'am? Way in the back, back row? Nope, okay. You did, yes? Go ahead. Okay, we couldn't hear you. You're a political science student here, and
a former student of Dr. Ferrier's. I'm just wondering if, since the public feels so disconnected from their elected officials, in 2008, Hillary Clinton, her yard sign just said Hillary. Like, it didn't say Clinton, I guess, to distinguish from her husband, who had been president. Would it help the public if they started referring to their elected officials by their first name, or does that offend politicians, or, you know, what's that element of feeling personal with your elected officials?
So we should call him John, him Trey?
I like being called John, that's fine. I wouldn't put yard signs out that just said vote for John. I don't think that would work real well, but no. You know, but you raise an important point. I've done more than 2,000 events in the district over the last 4 years, and the reason I do them is so that people will feel that they know me and that I'm willing to listen to them. And I think if most any politician will tell you that, if you can cross that hurdle where people really feel they know you, feel comfortable with you, and feel they can talk to you, then they don't care how you vote. They just have a good feeling about it. They trust you. That's the indispensable political.
And I think you've done a good job of that, frankly. I mean, as an observer. And I would say for me, yeah, go ahead.
I was fishing there.
Yeah. It's funny you mention that, because we'd kicked around the idea at some point of doing Trey, you know, because Trey, it's his speech guys, or his communications guys, Trey also, but there aren't that many of us, so I could probably get by with the Trey at some point, but I think John's absolutely right about the accessibility part. Part of what allows, you know, him to get reelected, part of what I think allowed me to get elected in 2007 and a tough year to be Republican is that people got to know me. And I got out, and I'm always touched by, I was a Governor's Scholar, and I just found out that Jasmine's husband, who I didn't realize they were married, was a classmate of mine. I'm always touched when I travel around the state, and I meet people who heard me speak at the Governor's Scholars Program, because I go every summer to all three campuses, and it's really one of the highlights of the year. And the day I was actually interviewing up at Harvard, I was trying keeping a real low profile, and Condi Rice was speaking, so I went. And two students came up to me, freshman and sophomore at Harvard, who heard me speak on their campuses and said, "Hey, we heard you speak at GSP." And thank God they didn't ask the follow-up, "Why are you here?" but that accessibility, it does matter. It is helpful. And it helps you to be, and it also matters because it helps you to be a better representative of your people. I mean, we have our views and our principles, but we want to know what our constituents think. And we want to know their concerns. And, you know, I've been in the executive, and we've done things differently because folks have come up to me and said, "Hey, you should do this." So that accessibility is really critical.
Let me
cut
you off,
Dre.
I'm going to take two more questions. There was a young lady right here with a hat on. You, ma'am, go ahead. You had your hand up for quite a while. And then there's a guy over here that had his hand up, too, and over here somewhere.
This is real quick.
Okay.
As a parent, I'm speaking about the poor little girl that was killed. What about the children? Somebody needs to take this to Washington. These children know what's going on when they hear this discourse and everything else. My kids know I'm over here today talking to you all. Listening, they knew I'd get a question in. What about the children? We were children. This is so frightening for the children.
You saying they're setting a bad example? Anybody want to tackle that one, John? Give it a shot.
I think you're absolutely right. But the people who have to watch television during campaign season in this day and age, I mean, how any person, young or old, could have any respect for the political system with what they see is surprising. Mm-hmm. And obviously, the younger you are, it was so touching when the president made his speech in Tucson when he said, "We need to live up to the expectations of Christina Lee, the little girl who was killed." And it's absolutely true. It sounds a little Pollyannish, but we all ought to do that.
Good question. Okay. I'm going to move on. There was one more. I thought there was a gentleman out here. Is it you, sir? All right. Go ahead. Last one.
You kind of touched on it, but who profits from all of this? And I know that Congressman Garland talked about public financing campaigns, and we brought up the disclosure of all the money that backs a lot of this talk. I mean, why aren't we talking more about following the money that funds the
Did you all hear that in the back? Did you hear it okay? Yes, no. The question is about all this political rhetoric. There's a lot of money behind it, and the campaign finance laws, there's just no easy way to figure out who is funding some of these folks that are engaged in all this angry rhetoric. That was the question.
Okay, well, got to step back. One time last year, the Supreme Court came down with a decision in the Citizens United case in which they said that corporations, well, anybody, but corporations specifically, can spend unlimited amounts of corporate money to advocate directly the election or defeat of a particular candidate, which has not been the law. And they also cannot be compelled to disclose who's putting up the money. We tried to pass a bill. We did pass a bill in the House, the Disclose Act, which would have required the corporate donors to disclose who they are. We have these American Crossroads and America's Future Fund, and they were all running ads. $3 million in Ben Chandler's race. I don't know how much in the Senate race. There was a ton of money spent, mostly against Jack Conway, but it was mostly spent on the conservative side, tens of millions of dollars nationwide. We passed it in the House. The Senate did not vote on it. Harry Reid said he couldn't get 60 votes. There is a way to approach that, and I would encourage anybody who's interested to try and get the Commonwealth of Kentucky to pass a state disclosure law, because there are statewide disclosure laws about this, so that American Crossroads, if they wanted to run ads in Kentucky, would have to disclose their donors. It preempts the federal law, and we ought to do that. I mean, I'm for public financing of campaigns. I think anything we can do to get the big money out of politics will make it a better democracy, but of immediate consequence, and it's going to get worse. It'll be worse in the next election cycle than it was in this one. So if you don't want to see basically just wipe out television and for the last 3 or 4 months of 2012, we need to do something about that. In Minnesota, by the way, they did have a law. They do have a law in Minnesota. Minnesota had to disclose it. The governor, gubernatorial candidate, was running. They were running stuff, and they were taking on gay marriage as part of the campaign. It became known that Target and some of the other companies were actually funding those ads. Public reaction forced them to stop.
Real quick.
This is something on the state level I've been fighting for more disclosure. I don't support public financing of campaigns, and I'm glad we got rid of it in Kentucky, and I'm glad I was played a role in that. But I have been fighting, and one of my disappointments is we haven't been able to increase our disclosure laws, whether it's campaigns or these third-party entities. I'm a big believer in disclosure. Let's get it out there. And for the record, in 06, the Democrats had groups that spent a lot of money against Republicans, although it was disclosed, but it was large contributions buying lots of ads. So this does go both ways. And disclosure is probably something that the parties can come together on and get some of that out there.
All right, let's kind of wrap this thing up. Why don't each of you, starting with Jasmine, give us about a minute. You probably had, I don't know, 150 folks in here. What would you tell the public? We've got this level of discourse. You say it's probably not any worse than it has been in the past. We're just hearing about it a lot more right now. What would you tell these folks? What should they do in their own lives, and what should they do to kind of make sure that the level of discourse in this country, we're listening to each other instead of shouting at each other, and that our politicians are doing the same?
Well, I would advocate a personal boycott on loudmouth media commentators and polarizing political figures, and worry about the debt and the deficit and the wars and the issues that matter to you. Those of us who study these things often don't have enough time in the day to become experts on Social Security and Medicare and what to do with the deficit. I do study those things, and I still have questions. We could all dedicate ourselves a little bit more to understanding the actual policies that will govern the future place of the United States in the world and the economic health and well-being of the citizens of the United States. All of this is entertaining. We like conflict. I taught Federalist 10 in my classroom this morning, which proves that Madison said we all like conflict. We have to, in our way, divorce ourselves from the need for that type of entertainment.
Okay. Trey?
I actually agree with everything she just said. I think a couple more suggestions that I would make is, and I guess I alluded to this earlier, but use the internet as a tool to learn more and to challenge your own beliefs. You know, go to the other side, if you will, and read arguments in favor of a policy that you think you right now don't agree with, or against a policy that you do agree with. There's plenty of great sites that are out there. So I would encourage you to do that. The second thing would be, we haven't talked about this at all, but one of the things that I think over the long run we need to do is to do a better job of teaching our kids in schools about civics education so they understand how the process can work, does work, and ought to work. And as a country, we've let that go by the wayside. We focused a lot on careers and on college, and we've forgotten the third C, which is citizenship. So that's something else I would add. And then the third thing is keep coming to events like this and keep holding people like John and me accountable. You can do that. Don't hold her accountable, but hold us accountable. But do this little bit by little bit. And I think just maybe conclude with what President Obama said about living up to the 9-year-old. That's the America we can and ought to be.
Okay.
I really shouldn't say anything after that. That was so beautifully said. And I'm serious. It was great. Couple thoughts. One is, in your daily activities and your daily discussions, and I'm going to try to do this. Trey already does it. If it sounds silly, think about the golden rule. If you would think that something was said about you would be unfair, just on the kind of the other side or whatever it is, don't say it. Just a corollary of the golden rule. Secondly, part of citizenship, good citizenship, is being well informed. The internet is a very dangerous thing, as well as being a very positive resource. I was at a meeting during the healthcare debate of the medical staff at Baptist East, and one doctor, you know, well educated man, got up and said, he got a piece of paper, and he says, This section thing says this. Doesn't that disturb you? And I said, it would disturb me if any of those things were in the bill. But they're not. And he said, well, I got this. I said, you got it on a piece of paper you printed out from the internet. You don't have the slightest idea whether that's true. If you show me any one of those provisions in the bill, then I'll concede your point. And of course, he couldn't. People, for some reason, give more credence to stuff they get on the internet than they do watching the evening news. Part of that's because there's been a concerted effort I think, and this, I'll pick sides, largely by the right to demonize the media, the lamestream media, as Sarah Palin says every chance time she has a chance to say it. The reason she's trying to demonize the media, the legitimate mainstream media, is because that's how she carves out credibility for herself, because otherwise she wouldn't have any. And again, we have some people like that too. So what I get people more than I would ever like to admit who send me this stuff and say, tell me this isn't true. And I said, well, what do you think? Do you really think it's true? And of course, most of the time it isn't. If you haven't heard it in the mainstream media, for the most part, you should be suspicious anyway. One very clear example, I'll make it short. Somebody sent me an article that was purportedly written by a guy from the Washington Post about a 2007 appearance that Barack Obama made on Meet the Press, where he said he didn't like to hold his hand over his heart during the Pledge of Allegiance because he thinks it might offend some people, and that he wants to change the national anthem, and he'd like to change it to "I'd like to teach the world to sing." Now, actually, if you read the first few paragraphs, until you got to that part, you say, what is this? You know, if you haven't been familiar, people are vulnerable to this kind of stuff. Well, first thing I did was Google the reporter, and who doesn't exist. The whole thing was fabricated. But you know, that kind of stuff's out there, and it's your obligation when you get it, not just to question it, but to send your supposed friend a response saying, you're crazy, this is wrong. You can check anything that comes on the internet, most anything, on factcheck.org or PolitiFact. They're both award-winning sites that kind of debunk a lot of this stuff. But we all have responsibilities, and citizens as well as elected officials do, to try at least keep the debate factual and honest.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, before we wrap up, a couple of notes. Number one, at the back tables back there, there are some groups from the University of Louisville campus who are engaged in bringing people together and doing good things and trying not to throw bombs, as we talked about earlier, at each other. In fact, they're